Hello and welcome to the Sotoxipod. We are somewhere in season three, and we are back with another completely random topic to discuss after a week long of research. How are you today, Toby?
I do just want to say how much better this intro went. While you did sound completely disinterested in what was going on around you, me seeing your video feed can tell that you didn't look at the screen for a second. It is great how wonderful
this. Thanks this for breaking down started, the wall.
It started without me shouting.
Because this is the first time you've used the camera to instigate who should start.
Yeah, 3, 2, 1, go.
And action. Any case, at the end of last week, we kind of decided that we would discuss clams this time. We didn't decide. We let Wikipedia do the deciding for us. And I wonder how long we can turn this into an interesting topic. I liked our experiment last episode. I what did you think?
I'm having fun. I like clams, man. I mean, it's getting a little clammy. Oyo. No, clams are really fun. And I like learning about a few new things. I do fear, because No Such Thing as a Fish did just have an episode about scallops, so I do fear that we're kind of falling into their territory. I don't know if you remember them. I used to listen to them quite a lot in the car.
Yeah.
They had an episode about scallops, and they also mentioned, which I got really annoyed by, they mentioned disco clams, which I thought were super cool when I heard about them today. And I was like, oh, this is something great we can talk about. And I was like, wait a minute, I know about these because I heard about them 2 weeks ago.
Well, I guess we're going to have to filter and cut it down a little bit. Maybe censor out the bits that have been covered before. But there's plenty of interesting stuff about clams. I was actually surprised at the variety of fun facts there were to find. And I was mostly reading literally not the use of the word clam, but like about the actual species, and there's a lot of interesting topics there.
So I didn't read anything about the word clam, is fair enough. Did we want to approach it from an etymological background? Because I fully didn't.
Well, I always thought a fun challenge for me would be to try and look at it a different point of view than you, and not knowing how you were going to look at it, I was trying to assume how you would, to get a different perspective on the topic, to give a full 360, you know, give it the South Park treatment.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I looked at the animal clam and kind of where they come from. And to be fair, I looked at bivalves in general quite a bit as well. But I think the most interesting kind of, well, not interesting, quite actually quite the opposite, but the most prominent thought that popped into my mind is that SpongeBob episode where Mr. Krabs made his millionth dollar. And they go fishing, and they get attacked by a giant clam that jumps out of the water and bites off their stuff. I was like, as a kid, I always thought, okay, well, wow, hilarious. This is a shark, right? I thought, okay, this is Jaws. And no, it turned out there is a super old story of people hunting giant clams and someone going, this clam actually jumped out of the water and into my bucket. And apparently, like clams jumping out of the water is a thing that happens, which I thought was hilarious.
That's interesting. I actually didn't read about it, but now that you mentioned it, like my granddad, he used to love clam finding. What is it? Clam digging, I guess, that they do on the beaches, on the shores. And he was, you know, a fan or an enthusiast. Mm-hmm. And he told stories like that as well. Now that you mention it, it brings it up. Yeah, I guess it's not a myth then. I guess it's a fact. It's just a very rare occasion.
I reckon the thing with SpongeBob didn't actually happen.
Oh, I'm sure it did. Everything in SpongeBob is true.
Yeah.
Same as the Super Bowl halftime show. Sometimes it's just predicting the future, like this instance. Sometimes it's the past.
I'm still pissed at that Super Bowl Super Bowl halftime show thing.
I went over to
a friend's house to watch it. And I remember I fell asleep like 5 minutes into the first quarter, woke up for the fucking halftime show, watched it, saw that they didn't play SpongeBob, and went back to bed out of spite.
That was my house.
No, it wasn't. It was Jules's. You were having your own party about it.
Oh, right. You came home afterward, and you came home while the game was back, and you sat down on the couch with us and pissed about it for a little bit.
That was the next day.
Yeah.
Because I had uni the next day, the next morning, actually. So I was like, okay, I'll be smart about it. Fall asleep, kind of early, wake up for the halftime show, and was just angry.
Mad.
Yeah. Not a good time. Not a good time. Oh, well.
My, if we're talking about animations, the funny revelation I had while reading around a little bit is that, the definition of clams per Wikipedia, it's like a general term for a bunch, like, what did you call them? Bivalves,
yeah.
Bivalves, essentially. So there's like oysters, there's mussels, and there's the like cuisine clam, but then there's everything that we kind of, as an umbrella term, call clams. And another type of clam is a quahog. And
oh, really?
Quahog. There is an area in Rhode Island that is called Quahog Country because everybody is, I don't know, there's like a lot of clams there, essentially. And on the East Coast in general, so that's Rhode Island, but like on the East Coast in general, in Boston, they make a famous clam chowder, right, from eating point of view. But the funny thing is Quahog is also the name of a city in which one Peter Griffin lives in a series called Family Guy. Which I thought was hilarious because that's something I never knew about Family Guy, that they just named the town Quahog, which just means clam.
They have the laughing clam as their...
And they do, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's way more connection to that. I always thought it was just a general, like, oh, we're on the East Coast, Rhode Island, right?
Yeah.
But I guess they're kind of taking a piss at the people there too.
Yeah.
In a way.
Oh, that is fun. Yeah. What I found really interesting about... with you mentioning that a group that it's called a clam, that it's called a quahog, right? I was listening to a talk by the Natural History Museum, and they had a clam expert, I guess, or a bivalve expert on. And she was saying how a group of clams is called something else, but I forgot it in the moment now. That's a shame. But it wasn't a quahog. So I guess there's different types of naming conventions for different groups of bivalves.
It could be. It could be a specific type too, or just like an American kind of term that's just developed over the years. Not quite sure. But there are a variety, and they kind of all go over the bivalve name, which is also interesting, to be honest, and a little confusing as a non-expert reading these various inputs. Another numbers thing that I thought was very funny about clams is the range of life expectation. Has like the worst confidence interval on a statistical standpoint.
Really?
Because, yeah, clams can be expected to live up to around at least 1 year to 507 years.
That's right. That's right. She was in the talk, she was actually saying this as well. She was saying, yeah, there's a type of clam that has a life expectancy of months, which are great for farming them. And then she was also saying, yeah, the oldest kind of clam that we found was like over 500 years and some fool ate it.
Yeah. And it was born during the Ming Dynasty. It's named the Ming.
It is named the Ming. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane. Born 1498.
Yeah, which is crazy. And do you want to know why we know this so exactly? It's because you can count the like ripples or the rings of a clam's shell. And that's how you get its age. Like a tree. It's crazy.
That's a good fun fact. Yeah. And
it's a shame that I knew that before researching clams from such things as a fish episode.
That's why you knew it. Oh, I guess we're kind of piggybacking, adding stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, 507 years old. That clam's seen a lot of life, or did. But I don't know if that, like, it's known to be the oldest individual animal ever discovered. I don't know if another clam will reach that age. I don't know what the oldest clam right now is, to be honest. But yeah, that's quite a life range expectancy kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a shame clams are barely able of like conscious thought. So they can't.
Yeah, imagine if they were. Imagine if this clam was actually capable of like what the Ming Dynasty was capable of in terms of like consciousness and brain power.
Yeah,
we would be living in a clam world.
Yeah, here's a fun thing. So there's a YouTuber called Tierzoo. And he essentially puts like video game stats to real life animals, right? And he always says, yeah, well, a creature's intelligence is how like quickly it learns, and then its wisdom is how much intelligence it can accumulate over life and how capable it gets. And one of the things he said is, or one of the things that was really funny was, well, squids are really intelligent, or like octopi, cephalopods essentially, which are kind of related to clams in a way, are really intelligent, but they have such short lifespans that they rarely get to the point where they are really wise and they've really gathered so much experience. So by, if we combine that with what you're saying, a clam would have super low intelligence and essentially could have, for all we know, could be the wisest creature in the world. But if you only add one to your stat every year, it doesn't matter if you're super intelligent. It only means you get nowhere. It's kind of like, you know, 5 times 0 is still 0.
But is 1,000 times 0 still 0? We will never know.
No, we will, and it is.
So clams. They also, this is another thing, right? So now we have this huge age gap or this huge life expectancy range. And it's still weird to me that there's so many differences. What criteria was like used, or why was one only, it seems like very few criteria used to group these into one big, like huge topic, which is the bivalves, which seems to apply to everything, like all kinds of differences, and like also where they live completely changes, how long they live, like so many criteria that would otherwise maybe define a group. Is it just the bivalve kind of functionality that's keeping them in a group?
Well, the bivalve is a very specific thing about having these kind of two like shell-like protrusions, right? Which is why some worms are in there as well. And then from there, you can type further. And don't ask me about these sort of things. My last evolutionary biology class was 5 years ago. So I couldn't tell you exactly how we classify genus and so on. What I can tell you is that I know that there is discourse among scientists of like, how do we type creatures, you know? Because it started out by like, okay, these creatures live in the same area, maybe can procreate and are like, look similar. And then we got a phylogenetic tree of things. And then we realized, well, actually genetics and such a thing. And we started realizing, okay, there are species that are actually super unrelated to each other, but look really similar. So how do we group these? And then everything in between, genotype and phenotype, became a thing. And I would bet money that somewhere out there is a clam scientist who's extremely pissed off by some discourse between him and his 5 biggest rivals in the entire field of clam science for that particular thing, that are spending all their scientific time arguing over whether clam XYZ should be typed as this type of genus clam or this type of genus clam. Disclaimer, genus might have been used wrong there as a word.
It sounded perfect to me. But thanks for the guess explanation. I wanted to fact check you real quick. The way the Ming clam died was not that it was accidentally eaten, it was accidentally frozen.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. So it was pulled onto the beach, and essentially the researchers wanted to do experiments on it. So it was in the lab at Baylor University. And here, this is a funny sentence. Its long life came to an end in 2006 when the researchers, unaware of the animal's exceptional age, froze the specimen, killing it, period. Yeah, so good job, humans.
Yeah, I mean, we are quite good at that, huh?
You'd figure they wouldn't get it confused with other dead clams laying around in the research lab, right? It's like the biggest fucking clam anyone's ever seen, probably.
Well, is it size correlated with this type of clam? Like, is age a direct indicator of size?
Rings,
size,
right? It must have some kind of instinct. Well, I guess it probably wasn't that big. But still, interesting. No, maybe it wasn't that big.
The Ming's true age was not determined until 2013 by researchers at Bangor University in the UK. So I reckon
that was carbon dating.
So I reckon after it died, there was quite a bit of like, oh, well, you know, we've got this massive clam lying around, but you know, who wants to, you know, who actually wants to count all those rings? What are the odds of it being really old? Come on.
This is so weird. So, you know, I just read how they accidentally killed it. Well, right underneath it, there's the revision of age, which is what you just recounted. But there's a picture next to it with the caption, "The animal must be killed to determine its age."
Oh, great.
Just cut through the shell and bands revealed in the wake. Accidentally froze it, my ass. They froze it to just break it in half. It would make it easier.
Whoops. Guess who's getting a Nature publication?
Yeah. So clams. They also make pearls. And not just oysters, for that matter.
Here's a fun fact.
Here's
a fun fact about oysters and oyster clams. The oyster clam that creates pearls is completely different from the oyster that you eat.
That is an interesting fun fact.
But you were saying that not just oysters create pearls.
No, so you had mentioned scallops as well. And the thing is, like, scallops, oysters, mussels, mussels and oysters that are eaten, they are fairly, I'm not sure which way, but they all live in different, like, areas of the sea. So some are, like, at the top, and others are, like, way down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And that also sets, like, the kind of pearl-forming thing that's going on. So it's not, like, the big fat ones that we know off jewelry are usually oyster pearls, but there's a variety of clams that actually make it, which I thought was interesting because I didn't know that. I thought there was one kind, and that's why it was so rare, and et cetera, et cetera. And the cool thing is, as long as the clam's alive, and again, it's kind of hard to determine how old clams can be or get, but pearls just continue growing. And they're huge. They can get really, really big. I actually didn't look up what the largest pearl is, but I'm assuming pretty big.
It's a fair assumption, I reckon. There is probably...
Yeah, I think it's accurate.
Wait, isn't there... No, I remember reading about this some other time, about the biggest pearl ever found, and it is being sold as a full structure.
Okay, it's called the Giga Pearl.
It's Giga Chad.
So the Giga Pearl holds the record as the largest certified non-nacreous pearl in the world. The pearl weighs in at 27.65 kilograms and measures almost 40 centimeters and 23 centimeters and 21 centimeters. So those are the three-dimensional ways. So, like, fat, which is four times larger than the pearl of Lao Tzu, formerly the Pearl of Allah, which weighs 6.4 kilos. Holy cow, it's 21 kilos bigger. That was the next biggest one.
Dude, 27 kilos? That's the weight of a dog.
That's big. Yeah, a big dog. Like Mila. Like big. There have been claims of the world's largest pearl in recent years. However, only the Giga Pearl holds the title on record.
Jeez, they couldn't have come up with a better fucking name. You had the Pearl of Lao Tzu.
There was Mega. There was Super Mega.
Yeah, I mean, fucking hell, call it the Super Saiyan Pearl, for fuck's sake. The Giga Pearl, come on. Give it a name, you know, that implies wisdom and the creation process over the ages, the sacrifice of the pearl. The Pearl Jam.
Pearl Jam.
Classic.
Copyright infringement. The Giga Pearl was formed by a Tridacna gigas, which is the largest mollusk in the fossil record. These giant clams can grow up to approximately 4.5 feet, which is 1.3 meters wide, and can weigh up to approximately 250 kilograms. Wow. So much for big fossil or big oysters or big clams or whatever. And they're found in most of the oceans. That's terrifying. Dude. And the value of the pearl? $60 to $200 million US.
Yeah, depending on how much some fool is prepared to pay for it.
So 60 to something. So at least 60 million.
And that's one of the interesting things, right, about clams is, or I reckon bivalves, the species is present in almost every kind of body of water that we could imagine, right? Try thinking of a body of water where you wouldn't expect to find a shell. And it goes to show how incredibly old clams are or bivalves are as a species. It'd be interesting.
Yeah, they're everywhere, older, and they've adapted to most places too, which is also impressive. Like they're not they've mutated or they've gone in a way that they can live in, well, not everywhere on the world, but in terms of like water, it seems like most places.
I'd be really interesting and really interested in knowing if they're older than trees, because there's this, I don't know if it's true, but there's this like fun factoid bumping around the internet every now and again that
What
sharks
came
are older
first?
than sharks are old. Well, no, sharks are older than trees, right? Which I'm pretty sure is true. But I've never really investigated it.
Well,
Just by the
what do you
evidence.
mean? They've been around for longer? Like,
Yeah,
what actually came first, or
the
the
idea
life
of,
expectancy?
well, anything but the life, anything but the life expectancy.
Okay.
Because, aquatic life was there way before even the first terrestrial life. So I reckon probably the first clam was there before the first like land tree. I'd expect
Okay,
so.
yeah, that's an important definition because plants also grow in the water. Trees do too.
But a tree
So
doesn't
those
grow
definitely came
underwater.
first. Yeah, but there's plants that grow out
Yeah, but
into the.
not trees.
Okay, so like redwoods and pine trees and those kind of things.
Trees.
Yeah, so like proper wooden stump trees.
Yeah, do you have shit like mangrove trees or mangrove? I don't actually know how to pronounce them. Damn, my German is. That grow kind of in water, but they even those don't grow underwater. Huh?
Well, then it's probably creatures. I mean, that's generally what the question traces back to, right? It doesn't really matter what creature you take. But plants are creatures. Right? It doesn't matter if it's a shark or a clam or a dinosaur. You're
Well, the
still
di
asking that. Essentially, it's the same principle.
well, the dinosaur probably existed before, after. Well, here's the question.
Well, the thing is, the
Because
reasoning you go back and you
terrestrial.
just determine evolution, right? And you see what came first. That's kind of your goal to double check it. But yeah, dinosaurs came after plants.
Well, it depends on where we start defining dinosaurs then, because when we think of dinosaurs, I'd imagine we start thinking of kind of the first, like plant-based. Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm not evolutionarily gifted enough to really get into this discussion super far.
As you've admitted several times.
But the fun thought is clams were there before, or bivalves were there before trees. So you can look at a tree, you can look at a clam and go, one was there before the other.
Yep. So one, if you're ever holding the two of them or looking at one and holding the other, I don't know. Anywho, I think that's all of my input on clams that I've researched so far. Toby, are there any more additions from your side?
Again,
From the clam world, did you find any more pointers for
did
clams?
I find any more pointers by clams? So let's talk about disco clams, which are really
Disco
cool.
clams. Yes, please do.
So there are these clams or bivalves that have developed in the documentary or in the talk I listened to. They just mentioned like organic mirrors, so tiny organic structures that reflect light. And then when they open and close kind of their shell, light reflects off them and kind of starts blinking. And it looks a bit like the reflection of the individual prism or the individual mirror that is part of the disco ball structure. And there's plenty of ideas why they might do this. Maybe it attracts, maybe it scares predators away. Maybe it attracts prey. Don't remember if they were one of the carnivorous clam species. Yeah, but I just thought it sounds really cool. And it goes hand in hand with something no such thing as a fish brought up, which is that people started doing experiments on scallops, I believe it were, where they put disco-esque light in the enclosure and the scallops reacted to it and were attracted by it, which I also thought was really cool.
Wow. I like the name. Just the name is awesome. The disco clam. It sounds like the disco fox. Like it's a dance that you do. Honestly, that's what I like. That's the first thing I think when I hear disco clam. Also, do people use it as a disco? Like, have they actually tried to hang it up and like
I reckon they don't use it as an actual disco.
I reckon they've tried.
It's You reckon?
I reckon some researcher was like, this is a great play on words. It's going to smash when people see it.
Some scientist went, all right, what happens if we put 100 of these in a little ball and we hang them from the ceiling? Is that animal abuse? Put
lights through them. Yeah, they can be dead, you know. You can have cut them in half.
Gotcha, artificially. Okay.
Yeah. Totally. I did find, so this is another funny thing. So way back in the day, you know how we always say what came before money? We say it was like, you know, trading animals. Essentially, mm-hmm. we had sheep before we had coins. Well, in between there somewhere, or at the same time with the sheep, or even before the sheep, clams were actually used as currency, as money. Really? And it's called shell money. Yes. So shell money is a thing where specific types of clams that were, you know, more valuable, they were used to make jewelry. And so they, on the one hand, did that. But on the other hand, they were sent to like various tribes and groups of people that were using this currency and printed into specific forms and like used that way. And, you know, it was a currency before there was coin currency.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I heard that people used to make buttons, so like clothing buttons, right, out of clam shells. So sometimes you find clams that are really old, or like clam shells that are really old, probably not in the wild anymore, and they'll have a little hole stamped out of them, and that's because people stamped them to turn them into a button for clothing. Thought that was really cool, really creative. Wow. Too, you know, like before we had a lot of the like modern processing options, we needed to get as a society, we need to have this
more creative
creativity. Yeah.
And this was done like all around the world. So it wasn't like one small piece of the world was doing this. Like this was around the world. Clams were used as like jewelry and currency and stuff of value. Mm-hmm. Because certain clams, certain colors had value or were seen to be valuable, perceived as such.
Yeah, really makes money irrelevant, huh? Like at some point we all came together and said, well, these tiny coins, they have a set value now. It could have been little clams, you know, like we could have all gone outside and said like, well, the leaves that are brown are worth twice as much as the green leaves now. And, you know, who would have stopped us?
I don't know who would have. Any other interesting clam related points, Toby?
Any more clam related points? That's the second time you ask. I'm interested in seeing where we go next. So no.
Well, I was going to start closing the segment. That's where I was going, because the shell money was my last idea, essentially, or my research topic. I guess we could put it that way. I was asking if you had any more.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Let's move on.
Then I want to close this with a little clam related humor.
Mm-hmm.
So Toby, the other day a giant clam cleaned my house. Thanks, Mr. Muscle. What did you think?
So if this was closing of the clam segment, then I'll say as Arnold Schwarzenegger would and say, get back to the muscle. It's almost like there was never a break.
I think it was a seamless transition.
Remember, we could, because we paused and, you know, chatted a bit, and then we were laughing at the end before we paused, and now we're back.
I think you were living in a parallel universe there.
I reckon I was.
Yeah, because this has been going nonstop. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, dude, exactly.
We went from clams right to this in a perfect segue. We just didn't announce it because we thought it'd be smoother in your ears.
Yeah, exactly. A seamless smooth
operator
for the listener. All right. Yeah, speaking of, so let's do a little talk about Formula One. I see, so Scott is sharing the screen right now. We're looking at the new yellow branded Ferrari outfits and how they look just a tiny bit like the Minions. Just a tiny bit. And it's creeping me out and I love it.
There's a great other meme that kind of mocks this, where they show Charles and Sainz as small people and Mattia Binotto's face on top of Gru, kind of towering over the two of them, which I think is just perfect.
Yes, absolutely.
Minions are smooth operators, as we know. Gru is still a criminal. And some people have been calling Ferrari's strategies somewhat criminal, what they've been doing to their drivers' chances in the standings overall. With that, let's head to Zandvoort, which happened on Sunday, the GP.
Yeah, dude, Zandvoort was awesome.
Exciting race. Nice to be back there.
Well, so I know you didn't watch the race because I transcribed the race or most of it to you, which kind of shows the start of the race was phenomenal. The first like 10 laps I thought were really cool, and then kind of went down into a trot where it was really predictable was what was going to happen until the whole Yuki Tsunoda safety car situation happened.
So funnily enough,
Go ahead.
So funnily enough, this is a race. This is probably one of the races I've paid the most attention to without having watched it in full length, funnily enough, because I was so psyched about the race, but also I was really busy at the side that I would always like, I probably chimed into the stream 10 different times. Mm-hmm. And luckily enough, I caught all the exciting moments, but the tension building between certain like people colliding on track or, you know, the pit stop strategies hitting him. I saw Perez drive over the Ferrari gun. I saw Bottas safety car come out at the very end. And I saw Yuki's moment as well. I got a lot of the important information. And of course, the start was a fun one with, I immediately thought Hamilton was out for two races in a row. And that he was really going to have Alonso's words ringing in his ears or in his head later in the evening from the weekend prior. But it turned out to be quite okay from that point. But how was the feeling in the race in terms of like pit stop strategies? Did it actually, like, how was the tension from that point of view?
Yeah, so in a sense, the pit stops, in my opinion, can be categorized in two things. They were either really predictably good for a lot of teams or really predictably very bad for a lot of teams. The only surprise was how bad Haas fucked up twice with Mick Schumacher. And then everyone else either had like a pretty average pit stops. I don't think we had any really, really good pit stops except for maybe for Mercedes. But the tension was generally like, okay, well, we're waiting for something to happen. And it was kind of brewing towards the end when it became clear that Verstappen would have to overtake Hamilton on track, which then didn't pan out. You've got your hand raised, Scott.
I just want to correct you real quick and say that Perez had the fastest lap of the season, the fastest pit stop of the season on at Zandvoort. 2.09 really? Seconds. Yeah.
Was that not in Hungary?
Nope, that was last weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So there was one fast one, but in general, a lot of fuck-ups, a lot of unpredictable teams. And otherwise, it seemed fairly solid, I agree. Mercedes looked pretty good this weekend in total. I think they can draw a lot of positivity away.
Yeah.
However, one issue was qualifying pace. If they get that up, I think that's the underlying tone and the thing to draw away.
Yeah.
If they stop qualifying in sixth and eighth and start qualifying, you know, on the second row, then they have chances, like a lot of chances to win races. But if they don't have that there, they're going to be fighting with the, you know, the other drivers around from P3 to P6, maybe even P8. And that's just tough. Like you see it at the starts, you saw it, not Zandvoort, but the race beforehand with Hamilton going out directly. And like, obviously that wasn't his intent, but it happens quickly. So like qualifying is everything to them right now.
Yeah. Yeah. They mentioned as much on the official F1 podcast that was uploaded today, essentially saying, you know, that Mercedes is usually stronger in the race. And when they look strong in quali as well, then, you know, they're on for a good weekend. And what kind of stopped them this weekend was Perez stop, and essentially ending Q3 early because of a spin. Without that, they might have been fighting for anywhere between first and third rather than fourth and sixth, which I think they started at in the end now. So it is a, I reckon, I mean, I think Zandvoort was one of the tracks that suited them most. Maybe Singapore next or soon will also fall on that. And they did well in Britain, in Silverstone. So maybe they'll also go relatively well in Suzuka, in Japan. But in general, you know, the thing with Mercedes is they have such a temperamental car that is stronger in on some circuits and less strong on others, that I find it tough to go, yeah, they're really improving. I think they're noticing where they're good at and they're getting better at extracting the most, but are they really getting that much better overall? Don't know.
A good point. They seem to, the question I guess is as well, how much is Mercedes winning over Ferrari and how much is Ferrari just losing
Also
to
true, yeah.
Mercedes, right? Because they're closing that gap and they're doing a good job and like just covering the this race finish. Max solid first, amazing pace, wasn't really going to get, he was going to get past the Mercedes regardless of how that ended, even though I feel like Russell kind of took a jab at Hamilton the way he called it, but I feel like Hamilton should have called going in for the softs and overriding strategy. He should have. He was ahead on track. He had the chance to make that call first. That would have been a chance to do something. But
Yeah.
technically, you know, and otherwise, it's only Russell that can do it, and of course, he's going to do it because it betters his position. He finished in second, Leclerc in third. Hamilton did fall down because he stayed out, and you know, Perez finished the top five, Alonso sixth, which was awesome for Alpine because he finished ahead of Norris in seventh, Sainz in eighth, which he just had an unlucky race, some penalties that weren't his fault or a time penalty from the pits. And then we had Ocon and Stroll running out 9 and 10. Good job for Stroll, good pace and quali. He got into Q3, which was really awesome. Gasly finished 11, Albon 12, Schumacher 13th, which was really only due to the fact that there was the terrible 10-second pit stop at the start. And if you look
Yeah.
at the time now, like I was questioning why they brought him in so early, but their tire deg was higher. But that pit stop was 10 seconds too long.
Yeah.
And he was only 10.5 seconds outside of Stroll out of the 10th place.
Do keep in mind that there was a safety car, so all the times were squished together by the end.
Fair, fair,
Well,
but he could have been closer
actually, are
beforehand.
you looking at total race time or are you looking at distance to finish? No, you're looking at total race time, in which case you're
Total
correct.
race time.
Yeah, in
Yeah.
which case you're correct because everyone was then affected by, the same by the safety car. Never mind.
Exactly.
Sorry. Sorry, I thought you were looking
Yeah.
at the time difference to the leader. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And that's the point. So it's unlucky, but I think he proved his driving. Like he drove really well over the weekend. He qualified in, I think, eighth, which was awesome to see. But anyway, getting to the championship stand things, Max is like flying away with it. Leclerc and Perez are now tied on 201 points, 109 points behind Max. And Russell is only 13 points within second place,
Yeah.
which is insane considering he's not won a race. Max has won 10, Leclerc has won 3, Perez has won 1, Sainz has won 1, right?
Yeah.
But he's only 13 points behind without a win because he's just been so consistent all season. And it, you know, even though Mercedes have sucked, admittedly, for their standards, they're pretty close to still getting like second in the constructors.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I sent you the meme earlier, right? I think if Verstappen wasn't there and the championship standings were essentially everyone from second onwards, we'd be in for a fantastic finish to the season. The fact that Verstappen is 109 points ahead just kind of robs us of
Absolutely.
that, you know? Because if we were, what are we, eight, nine races from the end? And if we had the top two on the same points, and then every like the next four like people within 50 points essentially, so one through six within 50 points, we'd be like, what a fantastic season, you know? It's great. And
Yeah,
then you
it
have
would be a
Verstappen
five-way
who's just
battle. It'd be a five-way battle for the championship, which would just be insane. Like Hamilton is 30 points off Russell, right? So he's 43 points off of second with Leclerc and Perez. So 43 points in what, 8-9 races? That's definitely doable.
Yeah.
Or 7 races, I think it is. That's doable. And you would, the narrative would also be like, oh yeah, this can really heat up, especially if Mercedes now win their first race and yada yada yada, right? Like it would be insane. So yeah, fuck you, Max. For making it so unexciting.
How dare he be so good?
How dare he be so good? Yeah, he drove so consistently again.
Yeah.
What's gonna be interesting, there's been we talked about this last time too, in terms of the silly season and like driver movement, because we did have an announcement since we taped that, which was that Piastri is officially at McLaren, and that's cool. But basically, what was funny about that is that Alpine had apparently not a single case in front of the board. What came out is that like it was so clear that McLaren had a contract and they didn't. It really reflected badly on their, well, on pretty much the whole entire organization from every single perspective for that whole little charade. And on that note, Mark Webber, who's Piastri's manager, actually reached out to Ricardo to apologize because he didn't want to do him any harm. He also wanted to make money, I guess, but apparently it's cool. Anyway, so Alpine has a seat open, and that's kicked this whole rotation in that we talked about last time with AlphaTauri letting him go and who they would fill the seat in with. And they've made it very clear it's Colton Herta, and that they want to smudge the points that he's missing on his super license, get him into a test to like really minimize that and continue. So I think I've heard predictions that Alpine will announce by Monza as well as Alfa Romeo. So we'll get a lot of movement this coming week, I think. By our next episode, most of the seats will be decided. I know you predicted that last time, but I think we're 1 week away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think me saying yeah, by the time we release the next episode, we'll have all the driver market figured out is probably not happening. I reckon we will only get some driver confirmations after the season ends at this point.
Oh yeah, for sure. Williams and Haas probably.
Yeah.
Would be my tip. But the other interesting seats will be determined later.
Yeah.
Because Williams and Haas are still deciding on their drivers essentially, like how good are they? Can they keep their seat? And I think AlphaTauri is gonna keep Yuki. So that's set. And they have a set replacement they want, and I'm sure they're gonna get it because they have a real case. And it actually brings up an interesting point in terms of the super license rule.
Mm-hmm.
Because the history of it is it was implemented to stop people from buying their way in and not getting into Formula One on credit. So they needed to prove themselves.
Yeah.
But it wasn't created to stop great talent from coming into Formula One, which because of the way super license points are distributed among league finishes, like around racing in the world, IndyCar, which is where Herta races, is not as given as many points as Formula 2, for example. So that's why he hasn't been able to collect as many, but he's won like 7 races, been racing there for a while, and he's proven on merit that he belongs with the best. So it'd be cool to see him get a chance. He'd be another American. We could have 2 Americans in Formula 1 next year instead of like 2 Germans.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
I reckon there's going to be a German on the roster next year. But I reckon there's a good, yeah, I reckon so.
Does roster include reserve driver or you mean on the grid?
No, I mean on the grid. Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying Mick is going to keep his seat.
I reckon that in the unlikely event that Mick doesn't have a seat in Formula One next year, I'm willing to say the German lobbying power in Formula One is strong enough to get Hülkenberg back.
Well, I think Mick, if he does keep his seat and establishes himself as a driver, he will have a real chance at becoming the driver for Audi
down the road. 100%. Audi came out in the interview where they announced their Formula One's plan and said, yeah, if you're a German team without a German driver, you're not a German team, huh?
There you go. I mean, look at how Mercedes started with Schumacher and Rosberg. So,
yeah.
I mean, Rosberg, I guess, is Monegasque, but, you know, kind of also German.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I don't, yeah, I agree with Ali. I don't consider a Mercedes a particularly German team. I reckon they're a British team with a German name.
It's really funny, though. Yeah, that's true. I was just talking to my girlfriend about that, and she had brought up that she had a conversation with someone who pointed out that, you know, there was a German team, but like everything's in English, and it was kind of a funny oxymoron, I guess.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Not, you know, I reckon it'd be a shame if there was no German driver and no German Grand Prix. In the end, I probably wouldn't care. But I reckon there's enough power in like German lobbying and German advertising, to be completely honest with you, that we'll probably see a German driver on the grid in the next years.
I hope so. I hope so. Schumacher just needs to get the Alpine seat. I hope the Gasly deal falls through. I hope the FIA, they said they were going to have a decision by the end of this weekend. So we should expect an announcement there as well soon. That's another thing that's coming to end. So that will determine the Alpine seat. You could wait until the end of the season, but you know, why should they? They don't have a driver to assess. And if like someone like Mick, who might not be their top option, but if Gasly is kept by AlphaTauri, they might want to swoop up Mick immediately, because if he gets another seat away from us, he's going to take it. I believe that he's not 100% happy with everyone there.
So they also mentioned this in the F1 podcast, is how Günther Steiner isn't, or like how the Haas team isn't difficult to work with, just how, yeah, well, they didn't say this, but it's kind of what I inferred, especially towards Günther Steiner, is how incredibly direct and straightforward he is, which isn't a bad thing. It just means that working with him can be quite abrasive. And I get the feeling that is one thing when you're doing really well, when you're Ferrari, to do that. But another thing when you're Haas and when you're trying to build something and build confidence within a team, and then to behave like that could be quite difficult. On the other hand, I always found Günther Steiner quite, you know, I perceived him as probably quite a good boss. So,
but just because, I think with him, it's because you're entertained watching him doesn't necessarily mean it's not entertaining to work with him.
Yeah, fair.
Like for the same reasons it could be entertaining, that those could be the exact same reasons that you don't necessarily want to work with him.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's kind of been known for years, like since Grosjean and Magnussen were teammates.
Yeah.
And like that he's not been great at managing their that way. And also with Mazepin, to be fair, like the way he canceled his the way he communicated to him that it was over, even though it was a tough situation, to be fair, and a very, very, like, you know, unique situation. He texted him. It's like, bro, you could, like a phone call. Like, I don't know. There's ways to do things, but yeah. If Mick gets in an Alpine seat, that'd be sick for next year. That would be absolutely sick. Oh my god, I might actually buy the first Formula One like merch in my life.
Oh, you reckon?
Yeah, yeah. If that happens, I'll buy like a Mick hat or something.
I'd buy a Mick hat. Sorry, saying Mick head sounds like there's a Scrubs character, which I think in the German dub, I don't know if he's called the same in the English version, he's called Mickhead, which sounds like Fickhead. So if you buy a Mick hat, it sounds like you're buying a Fick hat.
don't take the Mickey out of me.
Ayo.
There we go.
Anyways.
Full circle. Yeah. Anyways, so much for Mick. But yeah, I assume that most of it will be, apart from the Haas and the Williams, will be set after Monza. The whole grid. Right. So that's exciting to know. And yeah, maybe a week after that, but I definitely think some news will be ready on Monday.
Yeah.
So we'll see next week.
Yeah.
We'll see
The thing is, I like Gasly. I'd also like to see him in a seat other than AlphaTauri, because I feel like he's kind of stagnating there.
Yeah, he's going to lose his motivation if he stays at AlphaTauri longer.
Yeah.
And Mercedes, I don't know. Like, Mercedes is a real long shot because, like, if Hamilton, there's no guarantee he retires after next season. I honestly don't think he will. People seem to infer he will, but I don't think so because the season went like shit, and I don't think he wants to end it on that note. Mm-hmm, so it's another year on top of that, and then he has to extend with AlphaTauri for another year potentially to then wait for Lewis to retire. He has to hope that AlphaTauri's car gets way better than it was this year to be able to perform on that level. And then I don't know who Mercedes junior drivers are in the categories, but like they could pick up, just thinking of F2 this year, like Drugovic, for example, put him in a reserve driver role for 2 years. And
he's,
like, or
he's
Ricardo's
without a room. Contract, huh? Like without exactly. any contract, he's not tied to anyone. He's a true
free he's independent.
Agent.
Yep. So like Gasly for Mercedes is a long shot. And then like Ferrari's locked and loaded for the next few years. Mm-hmm. Red Bull is as well. I mean, I don't think Gasly will go back to Red Bull instead of Perez. I really don't think that's going to happen.
Well, that's the question, right? Is Red Bull locked and loaded beyond 2024 when Perez's contract runs out? I reckon they might give him another 1 year contract, but at some point they'd probably be looking for
again,
someone
newer. Again, that's Gasly waiting. So like the next car is the Alpine, which is on a 100 race plan, right? To win a race or to win a championship or something like that. So they have like a plan to get there and they can challenge. They're the most likely team, in my opinion, to challenge.
Yeah, I reckon.
Like for him available, because McLaren is also like locked and loaded now for a few years and he's just waiting for either Piastri or Norris to fall off. So Alpine's the only real shot, I would say, because I think he's not going to get another chance at Red Bull. Because he's been Max's teammate, and he's not going to be Max's teammate again, and he's not going to wait until Max finishes. And
that's
by
the thing,
then,
the second Red Bull seat isn't a desirable one now, because you gotta expect Max to have at least three more years of, like, if the car even slightly allows it, fighting for championships, and during that time you don't want to be his teammate because the team doesn't want a competitive teammate; they want a teammate who supports.
Agreed. So. The car is also not going to be developed in your way. It's going to be developed in Max's way. And Max has a very different way than most other drivers on the grid. So that's rough. That's rough. I mean, I don't know if one of the juniors would pair up nicely with him for a few years, then take over the mantle. They might have to go back to that pipeline. Hopefully it's good enough. But, you know, that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think we'll have a good race at Monza. Ferrari came out and said, "Yeah, we're bringing everything we can to stop the Red Bull winning streak, like hell they will." I think Mercedes, you know, I feel like they do less good. Yeah, maybe because it's a pure straight line speed track, they'll have a shot because they can develop just for that. Maybe they'll get out of their like high speed slump. That'd be nice. Alpine will be strong, I reckon.
And Alpine will probably bring really good like updates or upgrades for like track specific ones.
Yeah.
And their upgrades, they're probably the best team in terms of upgrading their car, like over the whole season. Every single upgrade they've brought has like improved the car. And I think they're like hitting, or like their target has been amazing in comparison to the other teams as well. Who else is going to be good? Red Bull's going to dominate. They're going to win, obviously. Yeah. I think there's no doubt in that.
Williams might be strong.
They've been insanely strong in the last few races on like the straights.
Especially in Spa.
It was crazy. Albon he set the purple sector in, what was it, sector one, I think. It was insane. And no one got close to, I think he also led the speed trap in Spa. He's been doing really well, honestly.
Yeah.
And I hope he gets a better seat than the Williams, because I don't know how good the Williams is going to progress as a car.
Yeah, but he's got a multi-year deal with Williams, and I reckon he's kind of happy in that. Just having the multi-year safety, being able to develop the Williams, maybe they'll get lucky, you know?
Yeah, I think he's cool with the development project, but I also think he's a really good driver. like legit good driver, and I think very quickly he will get hungry for more. So, you know, maybe in a year or two, well, I don't know how long his deal is. I think it's 2 plus 1, if I'm not mistaken. So after 2 years, maybe he says, let me go somewhere else.
Yeah.
If the opportunity is available, of course, potentially Red Bull, who knows?
Yeah. That'd be interesting. But then again, I don't think he'd go back to Red Bull just to be Max's second again, you know?
Agreed. I don't know, somewhere else. Who knows what's happening in 2 years and how good performance is. What Aston does, what McLaren does. It's so quick nowadays to fall from sixth in the championship to eighth. Or from even like, I think that's going to go way more together. And there's going to be three good teams. And it's cool. And then 2026, it's all new.
Yeah. Alfa Romeo is still relatively high up in the championship, and they haven't scored since Montreal, I want to say, since Canada.
Because there has, I think, most of the points scored from the lower teams in the championship were scored earlier in the season. So I think over the course of the season, the cars haven't necessarily gotten closer in performance. I'm not sure about this, but it seems like from a points getting thing, a lot of them got the points in the early races.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, later on, or it's just, maybe it's just like those teams are just not good for the tracks that have been recently. I don't know. Could be.
Well, no, you're right. I think you were spot on with your first guess.
Because like Alfa Romeo got most of their points. Bottas was awesome at the beginning, but
yeah,
you know, he's had,
they've been falling off as a team.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope they reset and come back strong next year.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Good. There's so much from the F1 corner. We'll keep you posted next time on whatever else has happened since then. I predict that there will only be 2 race seats undetermined by next episode.
Gotcha. I predict that the Italian Grand Prix will see 6 retirements.
Okay, we want to do 2 each. I'll do 1 for the race as well. I predict that there will be a red flag in one of the 3 free practices in qualifying and in the race.
Okay.
So 3 red flags. I'll have to actually watch all of it to count. But we'll see. Good. On that bombshell.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for tuning in. We will talk to you in a week's time.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.